Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
The recording has begun.
Oh, yeah. Like, okay. Because now we've got like trailed out. Like,
I know.
Okay, so the video's on. That's already happening. We're doing this. Okay, now we need to speak as if we haven't spoken.
We need. Can we hire an old-timey movie studio person to stand around and be like, you know, marker, speed, rolling.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to tell us. All the stuff.
Yeah, do that classic thing that happens in the Tootsie film where the guy standing with the cue cards.
Right.
With all of the lights, just pure SNL. Just give us the lights. Just give us the lights.
Yeah, exactly. Not a lot of people know this, Jimmy, but our podcast is entirely scripted.
Fully scripted. Yeah, we're so grateful to our script writers. They're just incredible. Wouldn't that be funny if that was like a big reveal?
Yeah, I know. The season three change, I think, didn't go over very well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when the showrunner left, it was hopeless.
It's been shit since then, I would say.
I know.
Especially since
we'll have a renewal.
How do you feel about us getting rid of Chevy Chase and replacing him with a different actor?
I don't feel good about it at all, to be honest.
I think it's fine.
Because what's going to happen is we're going to lose Donald Glover.
We are.
What do we do?
That's true. And we are nothing. This podcast is nothing.
It's nothing without
Donald Glover.
Donald Glover. That's what they say. Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theatre Happy Hour. I'm Jimmy.
And I'm Tommy, and this is the only musical theatre podcast with Angostura bitters.
And opening night jitters. Oh, here we take apart your favourite shows, muddle them together with a shot of buffoonery, and pour you a refreshing glass of musical theatre conversation. Tommy, what are you drinking?
Probably celebratory champagne.
Cheers.
I was gonna say
wedding.
From the mythical land of Genovia, but that's the wrong.
That's very wrong. Different thing.
Yeah. Although they don't really. Do they ever name the kingdom?
No.
All right.
But it's in Europe.
Yeah. But vaguely
indistinguishable
so.
Europe.
Yeah.
Because I can't remember where like the Disney one is set.
Yeah. I mean, they're all vaguely European. But anyway, what?
It's just like mainland.
What
Europe,
are we talking about?
Well. It could only be... No. Oh, I need to do a quiz question.
Yes.
Wait, you're reading it.
Oh, I got a quiz question for you to tell you what we're talking about.
Oh my God, do you? Fantastic.
You ready? Chance the Rapper recently saw inspiration from perhaps one of the most unlikely of places. One of the songs in this Golden Age musical. What musical could it be, Jimmy?
Obviously, it's Cinderella.
The prince is giving a ball. The prince is giving a ball. Piggy, a ball, and that's not all.
It feels weird saying Cinderella,
I
out loud. Do you know what I mean? I feel like we're kids.
It does.
In fact, I've got the Disney castle in the background.
You do have, yeah. There it is. Kind of. It looks like the Haunted Mansion.
It's a bit. It's a bit. What is it? Minas Morgul in Lord of the Rings. It's got that vibe, but that's fine. So wait, before we go any further, I discovered a weird coincidence today.
Yeah, tell me more.
So it turns out Chance the Rapper is so deeply nestled in the world of Cinderella that it's just going to spell the rest of his life, I think.
Uh-huh.
So in May, just there, 2 minutes ago, Brandy released a song called Baby Mama.
Okay.
Featuring Chance the Rapper.
Huh. Who knew?
I know. It's actually quite a good song.
I will have to...
And also, to tie in musical theatre, the video... was choreographed and like designed, inspired by Rhythm of Life from Sweet Charity.
Huh, that's fascinating.
What's going on?
Well, of
the
course,
worlds are blending together.
Our quiz question refers to Chance's song Zanies and Fools, which is, you know, an homage to the song Impossible from Cinderella. If not, you know, remix is the wrong word, cover is the wrong word, but...
Kind of like it samples it briefly,
right?
But also doesn't sample it any version.
Yeah.
But you know, it takes the music.
Yeah,
I hope he got in touch with RNH.
I'm sure he did. I am always fascinated because like RNH has a lot of, I forget what they call them, they're like R&H remixes or reimagined or
right.
where they do new age covers of their old songs with contemporary actors in a contemporary space. It just doesn't feel like a very Rodgers and Hammerstein thing to do. I'll find a link and put some in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
But they're, you know, it is, having worked with the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization, who sometimes licenses things in America, they seem like a very stodgy organization. And so it's always interesting to hear when they do something, I don't know, progressive is the
word. But that's
the
thing. So, yeah, I agree. But then they also have, like, In the Heights and Legally Blonde.
Right.
For us, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know if Concord has that.
Don't get me started on Concord theatricals. Sorry, Concord people, if you're listening. You got to get your shit together.
Come on, guys. I've not used them yet, so
I mean,
I have no idea.
No one's used them yet, so. But
don't they own everything?
They merged right around the time when people stopped doing theater, so.
Oh, okay. Convenient.
Yeah, well. Cinderella, right. As we mentioned, has music, book, and lyrics by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Do they ever split up who writes what? Do they ever say?
Yeah, so music is Rodgers,
book and lyrics is Hammerstein. And I'm sure it's much more collaborative. And this is our first original television musical, Jimmy.
Yeah, exactly. Born on the TV.
Yeah. It premiered on CBS on March 31st, 1957. And then went to the stage.
Yeah, so it had its stage premiere in London at the Coliseum. But not, like, officially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, officially, but not like, oh, it's, you know, the Cinderella you know and love from the TV.
Right.
It was like, and we're also doing it on stage, everyone.
Right, yeah.
That kind of vibe.
And then, like, it lived on TV. It went back. There was another version that came out in 65, and it really didn't hit the stage big time till the mid-90s for the New York City
Opera.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And, of course, what I think most people, certainly most people our generation, know Cinderella as is the incredible Disney plus Whitney Houston televised recording in 1997.
Yes, great production. And then it had was it listed as a revival in 2013?
No, it was a new
musical.
It's
such a fascinating thing to be a new musical in 2013 using songs originally written and popularized in 57.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's madness, but
yeah, made it to Broadway.
There you go. That's Broadway rules.
Yeah, new book. Yeah, interesting journey for this show, certainly.
For sure, but I think it's one of those things. Like, I feel like every iteration that it's had, it's almost felt like its own unique thing. Like, beyond just like the kind of contemporary R&H revivals that we know today.
Right.
It's not just like, oh, we've really polished the set in this one, or, you know, like Oklahoma, where we've really kind of retold the story in the same way, but it's all the same content, guys. Like, the content changes dramatically.
Yes, exactly. Which it situates
from iteration to iteration.
It makes it weird for like an R&H because all the rest of their canon is on the other side of that. You know, the original Oklahoma was made for the stage, and you're always iterating on that version. Whereas this is, you know, kind of lives as a set of puzzle pieces almost. Not anymore. Now that there's a 2013 version,
a thing. Yeah. And I think so. The 60s one was licensed for a while, and I think that was the one that, prior to 2013,
you could license. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes. But, yeah, shall we... I think the best way to journey through the wonderful story of Cinderella is to look at each iteration in turn.
Hop in my time machine. Let's head back to 1957.
Anywhere. Madonna in Milan. I'm an heiress who has always had her silk made by her own flock of silkworms in Japan. I'm a girl men go mad for, love's a game I can play with a cool and confident kind of air. Just as long as I stay in my own little corner, all alone in my own little chair.
Is that your TARDIS?
What's your TARDIS?
It's like asking people to do a Chewbacca impression. Like, no one actually knows how to do it, you know? Welcome to 1957, Jimmy.
It's really cool.
Everything's in black and white. Did you know that?
It is, and I'm in a lovely dress.
I do. So, like, what is wild, and it's hard to find specific research about this, but 1957, early television had to be live for the most part. Because of the way technology worked. And, like, live in that, like, everything you're seeing on the screen, they're doing basically right now, save for some speed of light calculations. And, like, that's just how all TV was for, you know, maybe through the mid-60s until we started getting some more, like, film technology, and then eventually VHSs in the 80s and 90s. But it means, like, that's why television channels would go off the air at night, because people would go to sleep. And it wasn't like you can play reruns or infomercials all night. It'd just be like,
they weren't recording them.
There'd be nothing there, or it's like a shot of an American flag and someone leaves the camera pointing at it all night and then they come back tomorrow morning.
Right.
And so that is the world in which this live musical is being created. As opposed to nowadays where, like, a live musical is... They wouldn't have called this a live musical at the time. They would have just called it a musical because everything's live.
Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be like, oh my god, the perk is that it's live.
Yeah,
what
could go
a
wrong?
Given.
Yeah.
And everyone would be really nervous. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Well, yeah, because prior to this, I think the main kind of live musical event had obviously been Peter Pan, which I think was only a few years before.
It was only a few years before.
Hugely successful.
Yeah. And then Peter Pan is how it was researching that for when the live new version of Peter Pan happened that I learned all this. But there were, I believe, I'm pulling this out of my head, so this might be slightly inaccurate, but I think there were two initially live performed versions that we don't have records of. And then the technology got updated enough that they restaged it, and then it was easier to record things. And so if you've ever seen the color recorded version of the Mary Martin Peter Pan, That's
from like the 60s.
That's what you're watching. It's a couple times later.
Fair enough.
And so we're right in that border. And it's why we are lucky enough to have it's called a kinescope version of this telecast. But this was new technology.
Yeah, exactly. And so that telecast, this was only discovered like relatively recently. So it was buried in the CBS archives for years. And they thought it just didn't exist. And they were all quite sad about that.
Yeah.
But I don't know who found it and when, but hey, thank goodness they did. So they've got, it's a film recording of the dress rehearsal of what became the live event.
Yeah.
Which is so,
it's so
cool. Like, what an amazing thing to discover that at this late stage.
Well, and I didn't know till we started talking about the show that it was the dress rehearsal either, and that it wasn't the live version. And that makes so much more sense because at the time, they weren't recording it for archives' sake. They were recording it to see what it looked like so that they knew for tomorrow what was going to work and what they needed to fix.
What needed fixed. Exactly. So, I think that is just, it's so cool. And apparently they had this like big embargo with the cast, that the cast couldn't see it. Because obviously all of these stage actors that they were working with are not used to being able to see themselves.
Right.
And so the director was really concerned that the cast would see it and get really paranoid about how they look or, you know, what they're doing and get far too much in their head, which I think is such a cool kind of conceit because, I mean, I don't really know. Obviously, I've not worked in a professional Broadway show, but I imagine there's probably some people who do spend a lot of time looking at the performance because we're much more used to like a televisual lens as opposed to thinking like, I don't want to know what I look like because I'm just going to be in the moment on, you know what I mean?
Right.
On the stage.
Yeah. I've often wondered, and I haven't found any good like sociological studies of this, but like in the same way that musical theater changed after we invented body microphones and then the art form changed around it, like the kind of stuff we made became different. Like, has performance in general changed once, like, as film recording, video recording became a thing and then became more accessible so that you could do just that, so that you could look at and see and assess your performance? Because certainly, for years, you had no way to do that.
Totally. Well, because I feel like it must, because I know there's so many interviews and stuff that I've seen of like stage actors who have moved into film or something, and they're always told, you're far too loud.
Yeah.
Like, calm right down. Like, this is TV now.
Yeah.
And they keep, you know, getting told to bring it back. So I don't doubt that there has been a huge...
There's some,
you know,
brain change.
Difference made there. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. But yeah, so this 1957 telecast, it exists, and it is weirdly kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
In a very like, the 1950s
right.
kind of way.
Yeah.
Like, is this the best way to watch the Cinderella musical?
Probably not.
Hands down, no. not at all. But is it worth watching for Julie Andrews alone?
Absolutely.
100%. She is stellar in it.
She's so good. And it is
like,
yeah.
I forgot how, it's one of those things, like, even though I've watched all of her stuff, and like, you know, I've watched Mary Poppins so recently, but you just, every time she pops up, you're like, oh my God, you are so good.
Right. And this is pre-Sound of Music. You know, that was 65.
This happened, I think, simultaneously with My Fair Lady. She was on Broadway with My Fair Lady at this moment.
That makes sense.
And then filmed this. So she's still new, like, she's still not Julie Andrews.
Right.
At this point.
Yeah.
Well, which is crazy.
It's also just an interesting... like art study, like certainly the whole thing's a time capsule, right? And we don't have a lot of recordings from this time because of the technological stuff. And I just find it interesting that it is an early example of what we know to be this Broadway musical theater style, Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, inventing it as they go, right?
Yeah.
Adapted for television, as opposed to a film of a play or a film of a musical. On stage, like there's sets, there's, you know, camera angles. They've made some choices here, and it's early television, so there's a ton of limitations just based on like the size of the camera and how close you have to be to the microphone and stuff. But it's, you know, they had to start it. They were inventing this stuff as they went along.
Exactly. And it was hugely successful. So, it was from a documentary about it, but they were said apparently that it would take about 110 years for that many people who watched it. It was something like 105 million people in the US alone.
Yeah.
Also, like, I think it was broadcast in Canada. It was also broadcast in like the territories in Cuba and things like that. So like it must have been higher up into the 120s or something. Like that many people watching that event. Obviously at that time it was the biggest event.
Oh.
Ever.
Absolutely.
And I looked up the stats as well today, and it's still in like the top 10.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. But yeah, so that, I think 110 years for that many people to go and see it if it was
the just theater, a stage production. Yeah.
Which is mad to think.
It does. Like, it's a huge, I mean, Take a Drink Now. I remember when we were having conversations during the cast recording of Comet about like the vast inequity between, you know, if like a show never gets a cast recording, how few people will exist, how will hear it at all, you know, if a show never gets a pro shot or some kind of adaptation like this, how few people see it. And it's interesting to talk about it nowadays where there is this kind of like bootleg discourse that's been going on during quarantines and, you know, of like an equity statement, plus like Hamilton on Disney Plus, like this stuff is fresh again, just the question of how should we be doing musical theater so that everyone has access to it.
Exactly.
And this is, and we've been talking about it since 1957.
Well, that's it. I think it's a really interesting point. And it did kind of get me thinking, because I mean, obviously we know that at that time you only had a handful of channels,
right?
You know what I mean? And people paid attention to things like what's happening in the theater.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, people were like, oh, fantastic, we'll watch that. And like, for example, they did a huge kind of press run-up to it, which is again kind of unprecedented for this. So they did a cast album,
right?
Which is nuts. That was set for release the Monday after it premiered, which I think is so smart. That's really kind of genius.
Yeah.
Then they also had Rodgers and Hammerstein go on Ed Sullivan, which we know from Bye Bye Birdie is a huge deal,
right?
Yes, and they went on to Ed, and they did a song from the show. And again, in those times, that was such an exciting thing, because it was like, oh my god,
right,
the new, you know. Whereas now, like, that would get dropped on YouTube,
right? Exactly. Like, you know, Good Morning America every other Monday was like, and now we're gonna watch the cast of Hadestown perform whatever,
right? And you've already heard it 10 years ago because Anais Mitchell did a Instagram live of her in the studio. Like, there's no, you know what I mean, there's no like anticipation build up. So I can totally understand why it wouldn't have the same impact nowadays. But obviously, with, you know, theater having a big question mark over it, this could be a really interesting way of kind of doing it again, like just doing a different
like a show written for, you know, distance broadcasting explicitly.
Exactly. Now, I had a browse at it, and obviously there has been a few that people have done really quickly and had this really quick turnover and produce things. And there's a lot of like, we'll do last 5 years because, you know, we don't need to talk
in the same space. It suits itself.
But I wonder, like, as time goes on, are people going to think, well, I don't need to write this show for a house.
Right.
Because I now know that we've got all of these myriads of streaming services. And who knows if people are actually going to want to go into a house.
Right.
You know what I mean? Is actually streaming going to be the best way forward?
Well, and it does, like, because this is written as a three-act musical, likely partially because that's for the time, but I also imagine the length is like, this is as long as like we can kind of go before we all kind of just need to take a commercial break for a second to like move the set to get to the next place. And you know, and like Peter Pan Televised is the same way, whereas stage musicals have shifted to a one or two act structure to keep people in the seat so they don't leave. And like, will we start seeing the art form change again because of this?
Exactly. Like, thinking, like, factoring in commercial breaks, because that was the thing, is when they wrote it, they factored in the commercial breaks.
Right.
And that's what's different when you look at things like Grease Live or The Wiz Live. The commercial breaks come and you're like,
right, why
that
here?
Was jarring. Yeah. Like that, you're just like, that wasn't the right beat to do that in. Like, there was no other beat that you could have done it. There's no perfect time, but it just wasn't the right moment to take a break.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it was like beat of a big number or end of a romantic scene with a big orchestral swell. Da, 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 bum, commercial break. So it was like little intervals, basically, that you had, which is just, that's very smart.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean? Like to cater for that specifically. So, I don't know. I just feel like, because when we were chatting about in Beetlejuice, and I was obviously talking about like, oh, you know, TikTok is the end of musical theater.
Sure,
blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But actually, what are we going to see? Like some kind of weird TikTok musical? Well, like, are people going to be thinking, well, I need to think of new platforms?
I mean, and I've had this thought with how accessible and I think coveted after these days, like virtual reality headsets are becoming. And like, if we do we see, you know, television was this new and exciting medium, and the masters of the form musical theater were like, let's figure out how we're going to use this medium with our form.
Yeah.
Will we've got a new medium now, like immersive virtual reality. We see it with all the developing technology, not necessarily in musical theater, but even like with Quibi coming up with like, well, this is stuff you can only see on your phone because phones are a newer thing. And like the media is made, or the media is made for the medium. And will we start
podcast musicals?
Yeah. Like and written for The Thing.
Specific thing.
So it's just interesting to see how these performance venues kind of overlap, especially with our art form that is so tied to the stage in its, like, you know, prototype version.
Yeah.
That, like, when you start leaving the stage and embracing the other, you know, the dangly bits of the form, how that changes things.
For sure. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a very kind of new frontier-y, interesting idea. Like, will that be the renaissance that we get after a dark period?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Is that what's going to happen, where it's like, actually, you're going to be able to create art literally wherever you want to, and it can be good? I don't know.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, though, as you were talking about VR, can you imagine watching Comet in VR?
Oh, it would be great.
That's like the perfect one.
I know. Well, and that's the thing I wonder, like, I've had this thought, you know, we're recording in August of 2020. You know, the world's being hit by the coronavirus pandemic. If you're listening to this in 50 years and you're like, what's going on? And there's a lot of internet discourse these days. Oh, also Hamilton was released on Disney Plus. And these two things together have created a massive amount of internet discourse around, like, bootlegs of musicals and should musicals be performed in just New York. And there's a whole discussion of equity around this. You know, and like, there was a bunch of ragging on the Lincoln Center Library's archives, and like, why can't they just release the archives? You know, why are they like holding these things down? And there's
exactly,
it's a tough conversation for sure. But like, and also a conversation like, pro shoots are expensive and there's lots of rights to manage with this. But you plop a VR recording bulb down in one seat for Great Comet, do the show, you're done. I got to play around with a VR headset recently, and there is actually it's funny you mentioned Beetlejuice. I think Good Morning America did a 360 recording of Beetlejuice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I watched it, and like, I've seen it on a computer where you can like scroll around and look. But when you put the headset on and watch the thing, like, and I'm a techie guy, I found myself like looking down in the orchestra pit and like looking up at the spotlights, and like, you know, it's just a different, it is more close to obviously feeling like you're watching the show, you know? And so then it becomes this question, like even with Cinderella, I wonder if they had these conversations at the time, or if they just moved so quickly that like they didn't get as heady about it as we get heady about everything.
If they had the conversation like, should we do this in VR?
Yeah, exactly. Like, should we pull out our secret VR? But like, was there a plan at one point to just like get a, you know, have fewer sets, do it like a stage show, you know, because that's the form they knew? Or like, because you can tell they went the other way. They make a lot of choices around, like, we can only do this because we have television cameras. And even, like, Jimmy and I were talking before about the dress transformation, which on the 57 version, you know, as much special effects as they can, they, like...
overlaying a sparkler.
Yep, and, like, they pan away from Julie Andrews, and the fairy godmother kind of, like, stands there for a second, and they pan back to Julie Andrews, and she's in the dress, right? Much harder to do on stage, and also much less impressive if she like leaves and comes back, to the point where by the time you hit the 2013 version, we'll get there later on my segue, they have to invest in like a really fantastical costume transformation to sell that moment. And like, you couldn't have done that sort of thing maybe in the 50s, not nearly as successfully.
I mean, it would be hugely pioneering if they did.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they would have had to spend a lot of time.
Yeah.
Because like quick changes as you can kind of chart quick changes over the years.
Yeah.
And even just in recent years, like the difference between like the Legally Blonde quick change to the Cinderella quick change, that's what, 6 year difference?
Yeah.
But it's huge.
Even,
like the actual difference is huge.
Even just the, you know, like apples to apples, the like Hyperion Disney Parks Frozen show dress transformation and then the Broadway version Frozen dress transformation are vastly
totally
different. And they're, you know, 2-3 years apart. Certainly there's more money going on, but it is interesting. Like Cinderella, if a living, breathing part of it has to be this dress transformation, right? Which it feels like it needs to, if we're song spotting or moment spotting, this is an important moment. As a stage show, is much more complicated in 57, so maybe Cinderella isn't suited for adaptation at the time. But we got this brand new fangled thing called television. Let's try it there. It's cool. It's cool to see that kind of come together.
For sure. So yeah, so all that being said, I definitely watch the telecast, but don't let that be your first outing, I would say.
I would whisper in, like, skim through the telecast.
I know, it's so short. It's only like an hour and 20. It's probably even less than that. Like, it's real short. And it's just the lightest thing
that's fair
on it in existence. It's lighter than the Disney film.
Yeah, I find it.
Do you know what I mean? Like, the Disney film has more peril.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true.
And it's just very, like, the Cinderella story, full stop.
Right.
And the one of the stepsisters, I can't remember her name. She's great.
Yes. Stepsister, stepmother, dream roles in Cinderella for me. Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Cool. We'll work that out for you, T.
We would be great stepsisters.
To be honest, I'm very tall.
And I'm bitchy, so...
And you're bitchy. And I do snort when I laugh.
There you go. And I do have curls that are matted to my forehead. Well, I guess that's the 97 one.
Well, when we do the gender-bent Cinderella story, that's what can happen.
I'm sure this is not original, but we can call it Cinderfella.
That isn't original, but yes, we can. Sure. Sure thing.
All right, Jimmy. Hop back in my time machine. We got to go forward a couple years.
Things are happening every day. Impossible. 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 Impossible.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, Suf's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
No, I want to do dun 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 dun.
No, but see, it doesn't. The time machine itself doesn't make a noise.
Ba-da-dum. Bum, bum, bum.
Here we are.
1997. I was 8.
Well, that was a jump.
Whoop. I feel whoop. A little.
Yeah, what age are you?
I was 8 in 1997. I probably watched this on television when it premiered. I don't have the most memories of being 8, but I'm nearly like, we watched The Wonderful World of Disney every Sunday or whatever it was. So
I didn't because it wasn't broadcast in the United Kingdom.
That's fair.
So I would have.
I love this movie, the Brandy and Whitney Houston version of Cinderella, which is, I think, its colloquial title at this point.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Calling it just Cinderella is weird.
Right.
It's the Whitney Houston Cinderella.
It's the Whitney Houston Cinderella.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, it literally says that at the start.
She was a producer.
Disney and Whitney Houston. Yeah, yeah, she's exec.
The story goes that Whitney Houston was initially producing it to be cast as Cinderella.
As Cinderella, yeah.
And then discovered or met or learned more about Brandy and said, no. This girl has to do it. And Brandy, very flattered, said, I will only do it if you be the fairy godmother. And it's a really sweet, you know, that's also what happened in real life, right? That's the showbiz story, is Whitney was totally. Like this one, and then Brandy happened.
Yeah, because I don't know where this is in, like, Brandy's timeline. Like,
because
what I did watch was Moesha.
Mm.
I love Moesha. I don't know when... Because I'm sure Moesha would have happened.
Sure.
At this point. Because she wasn't, like, she was still Brandy. Like, she was known.
Right. As, you know, the artist known as Brandy. Yeah. Moesha.
Yeah, it wasn't like, oh, who is this new
person? This is probably right around the beginning of Moesha. I think it, what does it say? 96. So we're right there.
Okay, cool.
You know, Brandy's.
We would have had maybe like a season.
Yeah. Brandy's becoming Brandy. Great. But that would be right, you know, if this premiered in 97, that's right when the show would be in production, right? 96-ish.
Exactly.
So that's how long it would take. So, and it is.
So that makes sense.
It is a great, great movie. It is, it's hard to find these days, unfortunately. It's not on Disney Plus, which is ridiculous. Well,
Brandy's doing a huge, like Twitter campaign currently happening, Get Retweet Kids, where she's trying to get it on Disney Plus.
I'm so curious why it's not, because Disney would want to put everything and anything they have on their streaming service. And so like, I wonder if there's some weird rights consideration with the Rodgers and Hammerstein R&H. Organization that is throwing a wrench in the worst.
You have to be. Or they're like waiting.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because obviously they're going to let the dust settle on Hamilton.
Right.
And then it's like,
yeah. Kaboom. Although having them both at once, so like your watch after Hamilton is, you liked this? Try Cinderella. Would have been.
Right. I mean, they've still got like their section on Disney Plus of like, you know, powerful black stories.
Yeah.
Like, it's weird that that's not on it.
It's real weird that it's not on it, and you know Disney Plus should get on it. But
you
can find it elsewhere.
Yes.
The biggest thing this show is known for is how multicultural it is. And I do like, I hate the word multicultural, but I don't know a better word. You know,
diverse.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Super fucking diverse. Yeah.
You know, beyond just Brandy and Whitney, very much being the first black actresses in their roles, in any major production that I know.
I mean, literally, Brandy was the first black princess.
Yeah.
First
like, black Disney. At that first point, black Disney princess. Let's be real.
Yeah. Like at that point in the 90s, we had not had that in common parlance.
Right.
At all.
Right.
And she was the first.
Yeah.
And that's incredible.
It is wonderful. But not only that, you know, the production actively goes out of its way to make you know, diverse casting decisions. So the King and Queen are played by Whoopi Goldberg, a black woman, and Victor Garber, a white man, who have an Asian son, the prince, played by
Paolo Montalban.
Star.
He was an unknown.
He was.
He was in the chorus of The King and I. And he got plucked from that.
Huh.
Which I think is really cool.
Yeah, and they're all great. And like the cast is super diverse. Bernadette Peters is the stepsister and or is the stepmother, and one of the stepsisters is white, and one of the stepsisters is black. Like they're going out of their way to like, I don't know.
Be like,
it's
cool.
This is what it is. This is representation. Yeah. This is diversity. And like, for any time that's breaking a lot of molds and like dismantling some white supremacy that exists in musical theater's existence, for 97, this is progressive. This is great.
Totally. For sure. It's quite divine.
Yeah.
Like I really love it. Because also, it's not like, it's also not turned into like the issues that, you know what I mean? They're not, they've not added in a race subplot or anything
exactly.
like that. It's just this lovely fairy tale utopia where actually race here isn't an issue.
Yeah.
What
I read was the only, other, like, certainly they made a lot of like musically motivated changes. But there was one, it's bad. There was only one, honestly, racially most motivated lyric change. In My Own Little Corner, she sings about, originally Julie Andrews fantasizes about being a slave in Calcutta, and already we have a lot of problems here. And in the Brandy version, Brandy fantasizes about being a slave in Egypt, which also, like, I think there's a lot to unpack in all these statements, to be honest. But that's it. And there's a lot of power in that too, because as much as it isn't a show about, you know, diversity or racial issues, it still becomes a show about these things just because of the casting choices, which is great and what it should be. Like, it's such a beautiful gem in its existence. Yeah. Certainly with flaws, but, you know.
And even, but even like, as you said, like with the music, they actually, they didn't change it a vast amount. Like,
no.
It was mildly reorchestrated. It's not like, oh, you're going to get the R&B version.
Right.
Of
like you could.
Impossible. Like, yeah. It's not. It's just got a bit more of a drum track in the back.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And I, that's what I really, really love as well, because it shows that even just down to singing, mm-hmm. it's not like, oh, you're black, so you need to sing R&B.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Which I think you sometimes see quite a lot. And sure, like a celebration mm-hmm. of
right.
rhythm and blues, perfect, absolutely, when it's necessary. But also, why not throw, yeah, you can also sing legit Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right, exactly. And it
you
is
know what I mean?
Rodgers and Hammerstein especially is such a powerful and interesting choice. And not that, I mean, I haven't done a vast research into Rodgers and Hammerstein's history, but I do think you can kind of page through their corpus of work and get a sense that they're about as racist as someone who's writing in the 1950s and 1960s is, you know?
We all saw South Pacific.
Right, exactly. Like, you kind of get it. And it's not, you know, it's not something to encourage. It's not something to be proud of. And it is of its time.
Yeah.
And certainly, they have a very white sound, which is problematic. Yeah. And I understand that that statement is problematic. I want to name that. But
well, it's why it's interesting.
Yeah.
Just on that point, like, I read an article recently that was talking about, in fact, I think it was linked to us by one of our listeners when we were talking about Brownface and Drood.
Yes.
And they were like, wait till you see Othello. Mm-hmm. And so I read about that and I was like, holy smokes. Mm-hmm. Actually, this has happened. This is rife in the opera world.
Yes.
Right? Which is, and then, so it was basically just reading about how opera is written for, literally, for white voices.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Quote unquote. Like, that is how it's, and that in its own, I was like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
Because that's implying that there's never been any opera singers of color.
Right.
Like, that's not true.
Right. But it does, and it does become self-fulfilling within the art form, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so obviously Rodgers and Hammerstein are born out of that operetta world. Mm-hmm. So the songs that they are writing could nestle
right.
into that they're, quite neatly.
They're seeped in the structure.
Exactly. But it just goes to show that actually their music is very good
yeah.
because when you've got someone like Whitney mm-hmm. Belting it out, mm-hmm. it's actually, it works perfectly fine and is still extremely enjoyable.
Right.
And if you've got someone like Brandy singing a bit more tenderly, mm-hmm. it's still perfectly nice. It might not be coloratura, you know, soprano.
Well, and but I bet you Brandy could have. Like, that's the thing, right? Brandy's singing it how Brandy sings, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Because everyone should sing how they sing, you know? Mm-hmm. There is, like, and I find our conversations difficult because even our parlance of this discourse is seeped in some of the inherent racism that's in the world of musical theater, in the world
yeah,
of performance.
For sure.
And so it's hard to talk about it without stepping in it a little bit.
Exactly.
But, like, everyone should be allowed to sing with their own natural voice. Like, if Carol Channing can sing how she sings Hello, Dolly, then there is no right sound, quote unquote, for
right.
these things. And anything that implies or creates this is, you know, racist and gatekeeping in its existence. And
exactly.
this movie proves it.
And it fully proves it. It's really great
yeah.
for that reason. And also, like, it's just lovely.
Oh, it's so good.
It's so, really lovely.
It's so funny. Like, yeah, I rewatched it last night. We absolutely need to link it into the show notes because I think it is my magnum opus video I've ever made. But I had a couple beverages with some friends on Musical Theater MASH, oh, maybe half a decade ago now, and we watched this. And, like, it is the most egotistical thing to quote jokes that you've made in the past to your friends and still find them funny. And it is still something I do on a weekly basis from watching Brandy.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Do you want to give it a shout out right here for the the musical MASH fans?
Let's see. What jokes do I enjoy the most? See, now you put me on the spot and I can't think of any.
I know what one I would pick.
Which one's your favorite?
The Pasta Bowl.
The Pasta Bowl. I'm still on their mailing list and they still send me marketing emails. When this video came out, I got a lot of very confused tweets from whoever runs this local pasta chain of restaurants in Chicago, Illinois. Why are we getting tweets about Cinderella and a video? It's weird.
I'm surprised that they didn't get in touch, to be honest.
I know. I literally said, Pasta Bowl, call me and we'll work something out on the video.
Absolutely.
They
could have done a full parody.
Every musical theater MASH video after that would have been like, this episode of Musical Theater MASH is brought to you by the Pasta Bowl. Get 20% off
your
next rigatoni.
And you just started by eating some... Yeah, exactly. We're doing a 20% discount off our family this month, guys. Just put in the code Musical MASH. I do want to talk about specifically mm-hmm. the adaptation, because it's not the exact same
right.
as the 57 telecast. And I think they did some interesting, good things.
Yeah.
What I did find fun was there's actually a lot of homage mm-hmm. in the Brandy version mm-hmm. to the original telecast.
Yeah.
So... in my own little corner, mm-hmm. I guess like the latter half of In My Own Little Corner mm-hmm. is literally like shot for shot. Julie Andrews Brandy and when she's climbing up the stairs and stuff. And it's lovely.
Yeah, that is lovely. I didn't even think about that, but it totally is with the staircase and the...
And the staircase, like hiding at the same, you know, I mean, like the same kind of idea. And it feels like an homage. It doesn't feel like lazy direction.
Right, right. No.
You know what I mean? Because it's not like it's hugely deeply original.
Right, exactly. And at the time, well, I guess I wonder if... When the 57 one must have just been re-released by the time they were doing this. Like, they probably had seen it, but I think they found that recording in the late...
2000s.
Oh, really? So it didn't...
2000s.
So they didn't have the video, right?
That's a good point.
You know?
But I'm sure
there's production shots and stuff. Like,
yeah.
But it isn't, you know... I wonder how... Because this was directed by Rob Marshall, so I wonder... Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so curious about that. If you know Rob Marshall, ask him. Why the staircase?
Yeah, can you please ask him?
Yeah, don't add any
Maybe
clarifying.
It was just that
just
beautiful
ask him
synergy.
Yeah, probably.
That'd be weird. That'd be so weird. But no, so particularly I want to talk about two of the new songs mm-hmm. And kind of inverted commas new.
Right.
Because they're from the R&H catalog. Yeah,
new to the show.
New to the show, exactly. So they included The Sweetest Sounds, mm-hmm. which is sung as a duet mm-hmm. with Cinders and Christopher.
Yeah.
Like very nice, like in its own right, it's just nice. It's very like, oh, I have
like,
this music in me kind of
you
thing.
You have Bernadette Peters, you want to give her a song. You want to give her another song if you can. Like
mm-hmm. And then what I love is the framing of Sweet Sounds at the start mm-hmm. with the finale of There Is Music in You mm-hmm. and just that nice little tie that this idea of like, you know, music and singing is your like power, like that's your thing that you can latch on to and, you know, move mountains. Like, I just really like that motif that they pulled, because it's not like The Sweet Sounds and Music in You are from the same thing.
Right.
I think Music in You was written just for Mary Martin for a random movie.
Right.
But I love that they had that thought of bringing those two things together to create this motif, which works really well for someone like Cinderella, mm-hmm. who, you know, has her own little corner where she's singing her songs and living her fantasies, do you know what I mean? And it's all about like, yeah, that is a beautiful thing to celebrate. I just thought that was really...
Yeah, it's very clever.
Quite intelligent when it came to adapting it, because obviously they could have just pulled any old thing mm-hmm. from the songbook, which they did do in 2013 that we'll obviously talk about
in
a little bit. But I think there's intelligence behind that. And also the fact that, like, There Is Music in You is the perfect finale for Cinderella.
Oh, it's great. It's perfect.
Like, it's insane how good that fits.
It's, and I do wonder if, like, I get this sense about Rodgers and Hammerstein sometimes. I love their stuff. I really do enjoy it as much as I find some of it stodgy and some of it seeped in racism. Like it's clever and lyrical and easy to listen to, and it all kind of seems like you could just throw it all in a big bag, pick seven of them, and make a musical out of it. You know,
I mean, potentially, but we're talking about a different time.
It's a different age. You know, I mean, different era, totally.
That's how you wrote musical theater was you just pick from your bag. And I don't know. I think it works surprisingly well. And what it does is, for the first time, it's really given Cinderella a strong narrative.
Yeah, which is
as opposed to just
hard to do.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. As opposed to just being the Cinderella story, it's now more focused on, well, let's see Cinderella as an individual,
right?
And how, like, how is she making her decisions?
Yeah,
what is causing her to make these decisions? And you know, what is the result of her making these decisions?
Yeah.
Which I think is really great, because not only, you know, are these young black girls seeing, oh my God, princess,
right,
they're also seeing princess who is, you know,
fully
a free thinker.
Fully fledged, and, yeah.
Exactly, and, exactly. And like powerful. It's all about like make your own destiny.
Yeah.
Like you can do it.
Yeah. And it does, like, I think they did that across the board with this adaptation. I think more so even than 57, just with some of the, like, you know, minor book updates and even just some, like, staging and moment decisions from scene to scene about, like, making real human characters in what is a fairy tale.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think, you know, it is perilous to try to adapt a fairy tale, especially something like Cinderella, you know. You gotta have the slipper. She's gotta change in a dress. Like, there's some things that have to be a part of the story, and they don't make a lot of sense because they're, you know, mistranslations and oral tradition passed down and appreciated. But it's also the stuff that people are looking for when they come to see the thing. We were talking about it when we watched it last night, like how ridiculous it is that no one recognizes Cinderella at all throughout the entire movie, back and forth, like, you know, or that, like, Cinderella meets the prince at the beginning in the hat market before he's the prince and introduces herself, and then he doesn't recognize her at all when she's at the ball. Like,
it's the update.
Then, like, she doesn't
everything.
She doesn't recognize him really either as the peasant from the marketplace.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, and then, you know, maybe Bernadette Peters kind of recognizes her, but the stepsisters sing a whole song like, she's such a weird looking girl. Haven't seen anyone like her. Like, you really have to, and like, no one thinks about this because it's well done. Like, yes, it's a fantasy world and we've staged it in this whimsical way to let you know this. But
yeah,
to then, like, along with some of that stuff, some of the more, you know, impactful stuff is like, we have the phrase evil stepmother for a reason. Like, it's a motif from this thing, right? And the stepsisters and the stepmother get some moments in here that really humanize them and, like, really make it, like, you know, when I was watching it last night, there's a backstory you can build that, like, Bernadette Peters is, I'm just going to keep calling her Bernadette Peters, is so pissed that her biological daughters are these, you know, rolling idiots, and her non-biological daughter is, you know, smart and clever, and so has done all these things to set up her biological daughters for success and, you know, throw her stepdaughter under the bus. And, you know, how did, like, you see her get frustrated with the, you know, how dull some of her daughter's statements are, and, like, it's humanizing.
It's very humanizing.
It doesn't make her, it makes her a little less evil. She's still evil, like, she's still a bad person, but giving her some motivation there in a fairy tale, in something that is, you know, as fluffy as sugar cake, like, that's a great thing to do. It makes it interesting. It makes it worth it.
Exactly. I think, like, this is something I really appreciate about the RNH Cinderella, is the inclusion of the song, A Lovely Night, which is when they all sing together as a family and remember the night that they just had. And obviously it's in the 57 in the original, it was like this fun back and forth where it was like, were you there?
Right.
How do you know this?
It's
la 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 la
and,
ha, ha, ha. Oh, and now the stepmother's joining in and that's funny because she's so evil.
Yeah.
In this, like, it is a bit more, because when, I don't know, I guess just because it might just be because Bernadette and she's very talented.
Right.
But you can see the switch. You can see her reminiscing about something that isn't just, oh, it was such a lovely ball. It was more like, oh, something in my past, love, it's, you know what I mean, etc.
Yeah.
And then she has that moment where she realizes,
yeah,
that it was Brandy.
Right.
And
then she goes, she all has this evil.
Incredible switch. So evil. And then has that really cut, I can't remember what she says, that really cutting,
oh, yeah,
speech on the stairs.
It's so, and it's meaning like, this place is a sty. And it's like,
yeah, just, it's so like, so forced. And it's that, and it is, it's that really human bitterness. It's not the classic Disney, you know, you're only lit in your eyes,
right,
evil.
Yeah.
It is just very human. I'm angry and I'm taking it out on you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. And I love that because, like you say, this is the Cinderella story. This is the frothy fairy,
right,
tale.
Yeah. And even, I noticed this time through, because I have discounted the lyrics as being kind of fluffy in this show, but it is, mm-hmm, in the DNA of the thing. Like some of the, you know, I think, Do I Love You Because You're Beautiful? I'd never, mm-hmm, really, like, I've heard that song 1,000 times and I've never really listened to it.
Yeah.
What a honest, like, love song. And I'm not,
yeah,
I'm not counting, I'm not really expecting these two authors from the 50s to be like super girl powery. Mm-hmm. But the question, like, do I love you because you're beautiful or are you beautiful because I love you, mm-hmm, is such a gorgeous sentiment in a world where it could be like, this amazingly gorgeous woman walked in and I was swept with her beauty. And like,
yeah,
it's not what it's saying. You know, there are even, yeah, like little quips in the whole thing where it's like, you felt it, you know, I think Paolo Montalban's Whoopi Goldberg and Victor Garber like asked, uh-huh, the question, like, you fell in love overnight? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like they lampshade some of the fairy tale things in such a beautiful way. Or even like the Stepsister's Lament, you know, why would a fellow like a girl like her? If you dive into those lyrics, it's very much like, why would he like such a, you know, she's nothing. She's a bubble. She's, you know,
totally.
She could pop in a second. Not, yeah, like, you know, oh, I'm so sad that she's more beautiful than me.
Right.
Like there's an honest, acceptable frustration from the quote unquote evil stepsisters.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Where they could have like been, and they do become mean, but they're not mean all the time. They're humans too. Which...
they're still human. Yeah, exactly. There's still something behind it.
Yeah.
It's not just classic fairy tale villain.
Right.
That's all you are.
Yeah.
There is a backstory, yeah, there.
And like, they didn't need to, I think is my point. It's Cinderella. It didn't.
Right. And they didn't in the 57.
Right. They did in the 57. The Disney movie doesn't take any, you know, the evil stepsisters and the evil stepmother are evil. And they're just evil. And they're shitty people.
Gus has more character than them. You know what I mean? Like, it's true.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is really smart about this, is that they've just thought more about it, and
yeah,
they've just been able to be like, well, what story can we tell?
Sure.
And I love that, obviously, Whitney has also had this idea of, like, I want to paint a multicultural,
yeah,
diverse picture here.
Yeah.
And put these people in the...
And it's so powerful on ABC Family during prime time, telling a children's story. Like it was, I did a little bit of search and could find nothing. Cause people get angry about everything. And I fully expected there to be something in 1997, you know, from some terrible paper or whatever. That's like a black Cinderella. How dare they? And I couldn't.
Yeah. Or just like, I see what you're doing.
Right. I couldn't.
Do you know what I mean?
I couldn't find anything. I don't know if I didn't find the right corner, but it makes me kind of happy that like it worked.
Yeah, but it's just because it's so unabashedly delightful.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing like, because there is nothing wrong with it.
Oh,
they're not trying to paint any particular stroke. It's just no, this works.
It's also just a great movie, from like the production design to like,
yeah,
rewatching some of the special effects they do with the dress transformations for like 1997. Mm-hmm. Man, oh man, they are golden. To like you know, Whitney Houston flying around in her shimmery stuff.
She can fly.
Like
she ain't got legs, but she can fly.
She can fly. The CGI pumpkin. I do want to see the behind the scenes where like Whitney Houston standing on a skateboard that some poor stagehand.
Yeah, that's like, literally what the it was a skateboard, but it was a truck that she was just riding on alongside. I love that idea.
It's fantastic.
Very good. Yeah. No, it is. It's really lovely. I just want to make one little last note before we move on. So I take it you've never seen the My Little Pony movie.
I have not seen the My Little Pony movie, as you noticed when I asked you about this when you put it in the show notes document earlier.
Exactly. If they ever did a live action, I want those two stepsisters to play Draggle, and I can't remember the other one's name. But there's two. It's basically the same kind of construct of an evil witch and her two daughters who are like young witches, and one is very, very tall and gangly, and one is a bit dumpier. And they're just like really like crass, but have this really fun relationship with each other. And these two would be perfect. So I'm excited for that to happen. The live action My Little Pony movie. By the way, the My Little Pony movie is really good.
I don't believe you.
We will have to cover it one day because it's a musical.
Okay, I'll put it on the list.
Maybe next week. Ooh.
Typing sound.
Honestly, though, it's real. Like, it's the kind of thing, you know, have an edible.
Sure.
Stick it on, right? You'll have the time of your life. It's really good. It's really good.
See, but now I don't like the setup of this because now a bunch of people are going to be in my Twitter being like, Tommy, you got to watch this.
No, I don't think it was that popular. Also, it's really old. I think it's like 70s.
Really? Oh, it's old My Little... Because there's new My Little Pony.
Oh, no, it's not like 3D, please. Okay. No, this is like OG. I think it is because like the main girl looks like she's kind of like hippie child.
Got it.
It's really good. I'm singing the songs in my head right now.
I'm sorry for you.
I'm not. I'm having the time of my life.
Quick, Jimmy, hop in my time machine.
Are we going to My Little Pony Land? I don't know what year it was set.
I was trying to think of another like cinematic time machine as we travel to 2013.
There will be one. Oh, I just watched Endgame. It doesn't make a sound again, but yeah, we'll use that.
Yeah.
Yes, so we're in 2013. That was only 7 years ago.
I know, it feels like...
Actually, I say only.
I know. That was a long time ago.
That was a long time.
Even in when time moved at a normal speed.
Oh my god, 7 years actually.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I remember this...
That's wild.
Did 2013... I don't know if I made a Tony survival for this one, but this was right around the time when I was deeply into following the Tonys as an internet personality. I remember doing research about Cinderella. This was Pippin year. This was Pippin, Drood, Annie, and Cinderella.
Wow.
Yeah, Jimmy made a long face, everyone listening via audio.
I did. That's...
Yeah. Yeah.
A surprise, because it feels way more recent than Drood.
Yeah. It's so... I agree. There is this weird disconnect in where I've decided these musicals happened as opposed to when they actually happened.
Like, to me, it was like 3 years ago.
Yeah, and then
that's what it feels like.
The non-revives were Kinky Boots, which won, Bring It On, Christmas Story, and Matilda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy town. Oh, well. There you go. Does that say something?
It does.
It's timeless?
You know, maybe. It is an interesting thought, and we can talk about it when we talk about the plot changes. But I do think like, Cinderella is such a nothing story at its core, right? At this point, you know, because it is so trite, I think, and isn't very, you know, like, you're only good if you're married, women, right? It doesn't have the best morals, even at its deepest unpacking.
She is the beigest of the Disney princesses.
Yes, yes. And it's, like, all about, like, it's the quintessential princess story, I would argue. And so, you know, it is an interesting question to ask. Like, does this music make it timeless? Does this, you know, this flavor of adaptation make it long lasting? Mm. Or are we just stuck with Cinderella from now until the heat death of the universe?
Mm. Well, probably just because it was such an old story.
Right.
I was reading recently, like, there's, like, ancient China.
Yeah.
They have their own Cinderella story.
Yeah.
Ancient Greece, I think, had one too. Like,
yeah.
Madness. Yeah. But love it. Yeah, so, hey, we're in 2013. It's on Broadway. Wow. My goodness.
For the first time.
Yeah. It's on stage. I don't know why it took so long to go to Broadway, because there were, you know what I mean? It wasn't like, this will never be on a stage.
No.
It had been on a stage.
Yeah, they were created, like, it had. They had made stage adaptations of it that were performed plenty.
Right. I think it was even performed at, like, the Muni.
Yeah. But not on Broadway.
But not on Broadway, and no one was like, oh, we'll transfer that. Really crazy. But hey, they decided that it was time.
Mm-hmm.
And Douglas Carter Bean decided he was going to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to mix it up yet again.
Yep.
But I think what's quite cool is that, like, 1997 very much laid the foundations.
Mm-hmm.
Of this.
Yeah.
It kind of paved the way. It started off being like, this is a story about this girl, Cinderella,
mm-hmm.
and how cool she is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then 2013 was like, it is a story about Cinderella and how cool she is.
Yeah.
And this is what makes her cool. And it just deep dives a little bit more into building Cinderella as a
Person.
Important, significant character. Yeah. Exactly. And yeah, I think it's worth talking about the changes that they did for this one in terms of the score.
There's a lot of them. And frankly, Jimmy can keep them straight better than I can.
Yeah. So, but it's also, it's not easy to track these things, because most of them, well, like, all of them are just, like, cut songs from other shows. But also, quite interestingly, it's like, this should have been in Cinderella. There's some that should have been in Cinderella.
Right.
So it opens, has a new opening,
mm-hmm.
Instead of In My Own Little Corner, or mm-hmm. the,
the, like, there's the Brandy introduction.
Having a ball,
yeah.
The prince, whatever. Instead of that, it opens with Santino Fontana,
mm-hmm.
Singing a song called Me, Who Am I?
Mm-hmm.
Which was cut from our favorite musical, Me and Juliet.
Know it by heart. I could tell you everything about it.
Like, and it's such a shame that Me, Who Am I was cut, because, you know, that would just be the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
But basically, it's a song about being a prince, mm-hmm. fighting dragons, and how awesome I am.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But with a little bit forlorn. It's quite an interesting, like, decent enough I Want song.
Yeah.
And it instantly, it's like, oh, this is a different story, because we're now looking at the prince.
Right, we're starting with the
really
prince.
Really the first time that it's like,
yeah,
we get to know the prince
yeah
a bit more, because prior to this, I mean, the 1957, he may as well not be there.
Right. He's like the inciting incident for the whole damn show, but anyway.
Exactly. And then, you know, it builds a little bit more Montalban, and this, very much, he is a character. So we've got that one.
Yeah.
They've got Now Is the Time. Mm-hmm. So this is, in fact, like, I'm just going to run through what the story is.
Yeah, because will help me,
it is
too.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen it, it's what I think you can buy the libretto.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it. It's its own unique thing. Basically, what Douglas Carter Bean did was just, I mean, he can tell he's just like, I want to write something for now. Mm-hmm. I want to write a contemporary story that has issues that people can relate to nowadays, which is, you know, the very much the zeitgeist of Broadway writing at the moment, the past 10 years. So what he's done, as well as diving more into Cinderella, he's also kind of decided to look at socialism. You know, why not?
Right, why not? You know, baked into the DNA of Cinderella is socialism.
That's what the Grimm brothers were really talking about. But yeah, so basically, the prince, his parents are dead in this one. And there's kind of like a steward character who sort of takes care of him and kind of runs the kingdom.
Right.
And the prince is sort of just the mouthpiece, just the mouthpiece is the face. And he's about to be coronated and things like that. But you can tell quite early on that this steward guy has kind of got his own agenda. He gets the prince to sign off and stuff that the prince knows nothing about, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a character called Jean-Michel, who is a sort of firebrand revolutionary who wants to speak up for the people who haven't been heard, and people have been apparently forced out their homes in this, you know, insert kingdom name here. And so Jean-Michel wants to speak to the prince, but the prince won't hear him because this steward guy is putting up this barrier, blah, blah, blah. He also has this relationship, you can tell, with the Cinderella family. And here's where the other major difference lies. Because we've still got the same format of stepmother, two stepsisters, Cinderella. But one of the stepsisters is kind of nice.
It's kind of nice. Even nicer than the 97 ones where they're just kind of nothing.
Like human-y. Right. Yeah, this one's genuine, like has nice moments where she has a redeeming thing. And also is involved in this kind of relationship with this Jean-Michel character. And yeah, so already
there's a lot of
to this. There's a lot of new stuff. So that song that I was talking about before, Now Is the Time, is kind of Jean-Michel's revolutionary number where he's trying to make a sort of call to arms to the people. But and I think quite intelligently, they mash it up with the prince is giving a ball. And it is this idea of like, we'll silence the revolutionary with all this pomp and circumstance. And they overlap it reasonably well. For, you know,
for literally being two different, songs.
Hammerstein songs being forced together. When that was originally supposed to be in South Pacific. Then with the stepsisters, we have a apostrophe placement change. It is no longer stepsisters plural. It is stepsisters one. And again, I think I like it more.
Interesting.
Yes. Now, like the stepsisters of the men as a duet is really good fun.
It's
as
a ton. Duet it's a ton of fun.
It's fun. What this feels like is it feels like a sort of wash that man right out of my hair style R&H female number. Right? Where it's like really involved female chorus. Like, it's got like the Many a New Day vibe, but it's been sung by the stepsister. So it's not like, oh, we're, you know, ingenues and romantic and it's all about love. It's kind of all about love, but in a completely different way. And that's what I quite love about it, because I'm like, well, that actually doesn't exist in the R&H canon.
Like not...
the comedy gal is always a soloist. You know what I mean? Is that right? Idowani.
I'd have to look a little.
Mr. Snow. All the, like, they have their song.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And in this time it was a duet.
Right.
But now as a chorus number, it just feels a bit good. And again, it helps humanize the princesses a bit more. Because it's like, we're all on your side. We get you. We're singing along with you. Kind of vibe. So that's also different. Then they've got the most random inclusion. Ever. With the song He Was Tall.
It feels... I wonder if we don't know enough about what happened here, you know?
Like, what was going on behind the curtain? Like, even though they don't do that anymore? Like, but, this is... It feels like okay, this is a scene change.
Right.
This is,
and we got covering. We can't cut the song here. Because they gotta, you know, we gotta mop up something or whatever. Like,
right, like it's really weird. It's a very short song.
Yeah,
it was just the original opening to "Hello, Young Lovers" from mm-hmm. King and I that got cut.
Yeah,
and it means, nothing.
It does not.
It literally is like the prince was tall.
Yeah,
that's that.
Yeah.
Very odd inclusion, and I would like to know the reason why. Like, if that would be one of those things, if I got to speak to Mr. Bean,
yeah,
I would say, "What are you playing at?"
Right,
or what's that got to do?
Like, were there memos from R&H organization? They were like, "We'd like you to include at least 5 cut songs," or you know,
yeah, exactly, yeah,
right.
Like, and he's like, "I'll just pick a short one. I need to meet my quota." There is like, so there is one interview with him,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, "This is the one I didn't tell anyone about," as if it's like,
"Huh?
Oh my god, is he was tall? The I cut missed thing it. From like, King and I." Like, no,
it is such a.
It's weird.
I do wonder, and it is because R&H is like pushing us to dabble into more of an opera world, and that there is like, there's a part of this discourse that we're not into is like people who came to see this show for the first time and didn't know what the changes were going to be. We're like, "Oh, me, who am I? Oh man, me and Juliet. Like, I'm so excited. That song gets some airtime. A Rodgers and Hammerstein. Great." Like, there are Rodgers and Hammerstans.
But not to know the cut things from, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you'd have to be deep stan for that.
Fair point.
Like, it's not. Yeah, because it's not like it's a standard.
Right.
Quite the opposite. Yeah,
it's barely
nothing.
Even, it's not even really a full song in its original intention, right? Like,
so literally the only thing I'm like, is this a nod to Into the Woods?
Huh. How?
Right. What's the song called? He's a very nice prince.
He was tall. Is that all?
Well, he's tall.
Yeah.
Genuinely,
yeah.
The only link I can see.
Yeah, that'd be wild. That's some like Zodiac murderer shit. Like,
right, exactly. Or like, yeah, I know. Was like that much in love with Sondheim that he was like,
right,
I'm gonna do this.
Yeah.
I don't know the reason. It's weird. Anyway, they also brought back "Loneliness of Evening,"
mm-hmm.
Which is a namby-pamby duet.
Mm.
And they cut out the sweetness, the sweetest sound,
mm-hmm.
and basically replaced it with this. And I prefer the sweetest sound because of that
because
motif
of the,
idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is just, I mean, it's nice.
Yeah, sure.
But it's namby-pamby.
Yeah.
Do you have that term?
Namby-pamby? I'm with you.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would use
Thank
it
you.
In, I would prefer to say fiddly-faddly-foodle, if we're being honest.
Well, we all would. But you have to get rights to say that. So. And then obviously it finishes with the brand new finale of There's Music in You, which we know from 1997.
Which is a wonderful choice.
Exactly. So they're like the main changes.
Yeah.
And it is a very different beast.
Wholly different show. And of course, like, that makes sense because it was written for television, right? You would want it to be as different as intentionally so. Although I would say where these changes don't seem entirely motivated by the form change, right? They're motivated by some like story updating. It is just interesting because like no one would ever let you do this with Oklahoma.
Right.
Right? Like to play as fast and loose, like maybe... Meet Me in St. Louis is and maybe is close to like this drastic of a changing,
that's a good point.
You know, for the worse for St. Louis. But it is also interesting because I enjoy some of the changes in the 2013 one. I think they add a new interesting thing, like a new interesting take on it. There is a humanizing, like it makes it feel a little less fluffy and a little more important while still letting the fluff exist. But as we've discussed already at length, there's not a lot wrong with the 97 version.
Right.
It's not terribly problematic or dated. I do wonder if the 97 version presented in a with a 2003 cast, which admittedly is not terribly diverse. It's about as diverse as most Broadway shows of the day, which is very much not.
Le Cisement.
But And so maybe that would lessen some of the joy and impact of the 97, but...
I think so. I think, like, it would make it... It's still quite fluffy.
Yeah.
Like, 97 is, like, Cinderella is a woman, and you can do what you want. You just need to make your dreams come true.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that theme is now in the thing.
Right.
But that's all it is.
Right. If you're just reading it.
Right. Yeah. So I can see why they'd be like, we need to flesh things out. And they do it. Like, the thing is like the socialism thing isn't so left field. Like, they do integrate it into Cinderella's character.
Yeah.
And there is. Because they have this thing where towards the end, basically Cinderella sets up the meeting between the prince and Jean-Michel. And she's like, this is a great thing that we need to do. And Jean-Michel, this is his calling. Like, I need to be more than just fighting dragons. I want to be, like, doing something and helping people.
Right.
And she's the kind of vehicle
for
that. And that's quite cool, because it's that idea of, like, this would never have happened without Cinderella. And that's very empowering.
Yeah.
Because even in 97, there's none of that. All she does is has courage.
Right. And dreams. And then she gets them.
Yeah, whereas this is like she's actively active, basically.
And I guess I could see the like writer's room conversation when you're like, we want to infuse some kind of, you know, discussion of an issue into Cinderella. Mm-hmm. Write all of them down on the board and let's start talking about them. It's like, well, we can't really unpack some of the like sexism or heteronormatism or, you know, like preferences to marriage and like, because they're so core to... what are the key tenets of Cinderella, for better or worse? Like,
they're going to
get married at the end, right? They're going to fall in love. You can't unpack that. So then what's left? Well, there is kind of a classism discussion going on here. Okay, how do we flesh that out? Boom. You've got the socialism storyline.
Yeah. And it's still, like, the kind of main issues with it are is it's so broad strokes.
Yeah.
That it's not like, wow, this is a commentary, like this is really like good, and there's loads of plot holes, but I think from the kind of bones that they had from 97 that was birthed like from the idea of 57, I think actually 2013 is probably the best they could have done.
Yeah, that's fair.
And it's still enjoyable. It's still really lovely, and it is pure fantasy.
Right. It's still a fairy tale.
Which we don't see a heck of a lot on Broadway.
No. And I guess, like, even, like, you know, post the 2010s, we don't see a lot of just general, like, fairy tale taking itself seriously as a fairy tale. Like, there's a lot of, you know, whether you've got your Into the Woodses or even things like Enchanted, like, there's a lot of turning the fairy tale norm on its head. But there's not a lot of things that's
Shrek.
Like... Yeah, exactly. Like, let's you know, flip this around and make commentary using it. But there's not a lot of, like, we're just going to tell Little Red Riding Hood. We're not going to put a, you know, a horror spin on it or make her live in New York or, you know, right? Yeah. Like, and Cinderella is just Cinderella. They do their best to make it Cinderella while, you know, adapting what they can to make it not so feel like it is from the 1800s.
Yeah, I feel it. It's just like, well, I could have watched the Disney film.
Right, exactly.
And I would have loved that, you know what I mean? So yeah, I totally appreciate what they did with it, and I think it's definitely still worth existing. And I don't know, like, the next revival, is that going to be
It's a good question.
Different again?
Well, and there,
like, how does that work?
And there is... isn't there a movie coming out, or is that the ALW version?
So yes... We've got Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cinderella fast approaching on the horizon.
I know. Run, everyone,
with
run.
The single worst art ever. The single worst art ever.
I only know it's so bad because I've had to listen to Jimmy complain about it before.
It's so awful. Like, it makes something... I'm trying to think of, like, a notoriously bad... I'm looking at my wall. What's really bad? I don't know. Someone like Pearly.
Yeah. Well, and there's just the, like, shows that...
Like, Original Pippin.
Original Pippin.
Actually, it's decent.
Yeah.
They had typography. This is pish.
Well, and...
It's pish.
Are they doing, we're totally off base because this has nothing to do with the
Cinderella
Rodgers and Hammerstein version. It's just the same proto story. But like, so if you have the artwork, Cinderella's like spray painting her dress on, and it looks like an upside down heart or a butt, maybe.
It's the shoe.
Is it the shoe? Am I looking at the wrong?
Or is that the dress? Oh no, that's the
dress. It's just, it's weird and stupid, and like,
it looks like it was made on MS Paint.
Yeah, and I do wonder, and like the font is stupid, but like the cat's logo is stupid too. It's become iconic, but like, you know,
the cat's logo is fine.
I had to get one in before the episode was over. But I do wonder if we are seeing something reflected. Like, is it going to be like Cinderella, but she does graffiti, you know, or like,
right?
Some
who knows?
Pish
it's
like
also
that.
Cassie Old Fletcher. I'm done. Did you say pish?
Yeah, you're rubbing off on me. Did I use it right? Did I use it right in the sentence?
What, pish or rubbing off on me?
Well,
yes. The answer is yes.
Excellent.
Yeah, it is pish. I'm not excited for it. Because I'd much rather see this again.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've literally not heard a single thing from the new Angela Duerva one, but I don't care. No. Because I'd just rather have this.
Yeah.
Because I know it's going to be better. But, hey.
You can still watch the 97 Brandy and Whitney one. So
I'm not going to do anything less. Hurry up and get it on Disney Plus, though. Come on now.
Eisner, are you listening? Is that right? He's the Disney guy.
He's the current Disney guy, I think.
Although there was some drama with that and they got fired. Disney Twitter is getting very close to musical theater Twitter these days, just in like followers circles. And I don't understand a lot of the words they use.
No. But either way, let's all retweet Brandy's tweet. Mm-hmm. Let's make this happen. Imagine if it was us that did it.
I mean,
we tipped it over the edge.
It wouldn't be the weirdest thing on my 2020 bingo card.
Right? We got clout.
We got something. That's for sure.
Hey,
Jimmy, it's possible.
It's possible. Come on, join in.
I do enjoy, like, it's a song I enjoy, and no one has figured out how to do the little bit where the fairy godmother and Cinderella look at each other and just go, impossible. Impossible. Impossible.
Impossible.
Impossible. And like, I wish, like,
well, it's better than what they did in 1957, which are just impossible.
Right.
Impossible. Right. Impossible.
Aren't they sitting in the carriage and like rocking around? Or is that the second?
It's a very, very close quarters filming. It's great.
Because like, you could even, I wish musically, like, if I were going to be giving show notes to Rodgers and Hammerstein, I would say, go back and intentionally re-syncopate them differently. Because right now, they're all, they're written straight, right? Impossible, impossible, impossible. Like, they're all on. And make them all different. Impossible, 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 right? Like, at least do something, please.
I like it.
Thank you.
No, not yours. The original.
Mine's...
Well, I say the original. I like Brandy and Whitney Houston's version.
That's fair. I just wish they did something other than look at each other and say impossible. I wish Whitney, and I guess you don't like, you don't want to give away that she does music or does magic too much. music. What the heck's wrong with me? It's been a long week.
Whitney does.
You don't want to give away that she does too much magic, because then there's the shock of like the mice turning into the thing and the, you know, the pumpkin.
Right.
But it would be fun if like, you know, Whitney like snapped her fingers and a candle lit, and Brandy went impossible, and Whitney went and like shrugged and was like impossible, and then like, you know, did another magic thing, and Brandy's like you know, like give him something to do instead of just like being on the other side of a table. And
yeah,
it ruined the movie for me, let me tell you.
2025 revival.
Yeah, that's directed by us.
Candles. Candles and snaps.
But just that scene, just that moment. Rob Marshall, call us.
That's the only thing that everything else will keep the same.
Now you can go wherever you want to go. Now you can do whatever you want to do. Now you can be whatever you want to be.
was Cinderella.
I'm glad we got it finished.
It still feels weird to say.
I do. It is, and it's a line in the Brandy version. I don't think it's in the 57, but she meets the prince in the hat market and introduces herself and says, mm-hmm. My name's Cinderella. I like to sit by the fire and play with the ashes. And like,
yeah, it's in 2013.
That's
as
not
well.
At least in the 13 one they call her Ella, and it's like a nickname, and like we uh-huh. get it. But it's like the implication in the 97 one is that her parents named her Cinderella, and then later learned that she liked playing in the cinders.
Well, yeah. Oh, I get. I mean, or maybe just as a baby, she just kept walking towards the fire, and they were like, oh, wait, she loves this.
It's also a part that never really, you know, you never really see her. I guess she does sit by the fire in her own little corner, in her own little room, but she doesn't really talk about it. Anyway, I've got a quiz question for you.
Thank you. What is it?
Our next episode features the latest outing of a composer who's been referred to as God in their past. What could it be? Asterisk, the composer is not Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, we're not doing that. Sondheim on Sondheim. Not yet.
Not yet. Although I do love that one, but that's not it.
Yeah, that's good. That's a great song. Anyway, hey, if you want to get in touch with us, you absolutely can. Our show Twitter and Instagram is at Jim and Tomic. That is JimAndTomic. Or you can drop us an email on our website at JimAndTomic.
And while you're there, you can check out our Patreon if you want to financially support the show. Thank you to our many new patrons who are joining us. Also, if you're interested, we are adding another tier to our Patreon, $5.
We're getting active.
Get Yay. Excited. Jimmy and I are video recording the podcast. We're not going to release the whole thing because that's just too much. But we are going to pull some clips of stuff that may or may not, that probably didn't make the final cut.
That literally won't have made the final cut.
And the only way you can see it is behind this tier on Patreon. So if that's the sort of thing that jazzes you up and you're interested in, check out that tier and you can see those clips.
Yes, indeed. But hey, if you want to support us in any other way, then reviews over on Apple Podcasts are still super duper helpful.
Mm-hmm. Or you can just tell your friends. Our biggest growth is by word of mouth. You know, tweets about us are so adorable and so wonderful. And like, it makes me so happy whenever people are like, you know, retweeting, like, I'm looking for a new podcast. Hey, check out this one. Thank you all for doing that.
Yeah, exactly. It's really, really nice. And honestly, as well, keep sending us emails. I really love the emails.
Yeah, it's a fun way.
We've had some great
fun
emails.
Way to pass the time.
Real nice. Exactly, exactly. And hey, that's all for this week. Thank you for listening. Tommy, cheers.
Cheers.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
That is a terrible sonic experience.
Metal straw, though.
It's like you're calling us in for dinner.
Yeah, exactly. What is that? Have you seen that kerning?
Ooh! I didn't know what you were talking about until you started to do it.
Woo!